You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 294, Exodus 24, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you doing? You recovered from the conference yet?
I am. It was a long but really enjoyable day, but I'm sort of back in the routine now, the boring routine.
Yeah, we appreciate everybody that came out, but everybody did wonderful, all the scholars. Everybody loved it, said it was better than they thought, and so that was a nice compliment. A real quick story, Mike. John from Ohio told me a story about when you went up there to speak in one of their churches probably last year or something thereabouts. His son was 10 at the time, Gideon. So I wanted to give a shout-out to Gideon because when John asked, because they listened to the podcast, both him and his son, when he found out that you were going to be speaking at their church, he was like, hey, Dr. Heiser from the Naked Bible Podcast is going to be speaking. You want to go see him with me? And Gideon was like, is Trey going to be there? And his dad was like, no, I don't think so. And he was like,
eh. I think I know what's coming.
Yeah, he's like, eh. So I want to give Gideon a shout out there because I got at least one fan out there. So sorry, Mike.
There you go.
He didn't come see you because I wasn't there. So.
You know. I'm sure he was promptly disciplined. You know, just
that was funny. And so it's just, you know, that's just one of the many reasons it's nice to get together because I heard lots of stories. But, you know, just a lot of the feedback from the show and everything you do and we do here. And so it's nice to hear that because it re-energizes me personally.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, it's nice to see people. People do listen. It means, you know, something to them, means a lot to them, actually. Just over and over again, you know, people expressing how much the content does mean, you know, and you're right. I mean, it's a good shot in the arm. I mean, not that we wander around looking for a shot in the arm because, you know, we like doing this, but it still is a shot in the arm. I mean, it's a great motivation.
Yeah, and also, Mike, switching gears here, it's a big week for me and you because we face off head-to-head in fantasy. So
Yeah, the Pugs are in desperate need of a victory. It's my only losing team.
As I am, and we were literally, I think, 10 and 11 out of 12 teams. So really...
It's bad.
Yeah, it is bad.
I'm going to give Maury some extra treats this week. You know, he likes whipped cream.
Norman's not involved at the decisions at all. No. Norman's just left out.
Maybe he should be. I don't know.
You might want to consider bringing him in. Yeah.
Right.
All right.
He probably get more points than some of my other position players have lately. it's been bad.
Well, all right, Mike. Well, you know, it was a nice break for the conference, although we didn't take much of a break from the podcast for the conference, but it seems like mentally we did because it was a lot of work. But back into the grind here.
And yep. We're back in the regular mode.
Exodus 24, the first part of Exodus 24, at least.
Yeah, today is Exodus 24, 1 through 8, and we're going to do Exodus 24 in two parts. You know, there's a good bit to talk about here in both parts that, you know, some of it is going to be just dealing with what is sort of visible. And then part of it is going to be dealing with some things that we may not associate with the text of Exodus 24, but that scholars do talk about, do associate. So Exodus 24, I mean, just generally is obviously the culmination of the Sinai scene in Exodus that began back in chapter 19. We get the climax of that here, and the events here are also the focal point of the initial demand to Pharaoh. Remember that? Remember Pharaoh way back when? The initial demand to Pharaoh that Israel be released so that they could go into the wilderness to sacrifice to their God. That was way back in Exodus 5, verse 3. You know, and Sarna, you know, sort of bookends, you know, comments on those bookends this way. He says, the stipulations of the covenant between God and Israel, the rules and principles that are henceforth to govern Israelite society, have been promulgated. They've already been given. The climactic scene in the historic covenant drama is about to be enacted. An elaborate rite of ratification takes place, after which Moses is called upon to ascend Mount Sinai in order to receive the tangible, permanent symbol of the covenant, the two stone tablets into which the Decalogue is incised. Now, again, the whole point is that when Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, hey, you know, God says, let my son go that he can go out into the desert 3 days, journey and sacrifice to me. It wasn't like just a random sort of thing. This is what he had in mind because this is the only sacrificial ceremony, I mean, up to from that point on to this point, that we have. So this is the culmination. I'm going to read Exodus 24, 1 through 8, and then we'll just jump in here. So with that setting, here's what the text says. Then he, again, presumably God in the first verse, he said to Moses, come up to the Lord. There you have a third person reference again. Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu and the 70 of the elders of Israel and worship from afar. Moses alone shall come to the Lord, come near to the Lord, but the others shall not come near and the people shall not come up with him. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. So that's the first 8 verses, what we'll focus on in this episode. And if you noticed, in the first 2 verses, God invites Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, 70 of the elders of Israel, up, but they're not all at the same place. Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but the others shall not come near, and the people shall not come up with him. So we have essentially the Sinai area divided into gradations of access to Yahweh, something like zones, and that is going to, you know, be the setting that precedes, again, the actual conversation Moses has with the people and then the ritual itself. Now, come up is kind of interesting in and of itself because way back in Exodus 20, we read, this is Exodus 20:21, the people stood afar off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. So Moses was already up on the mountain. So we have to presume as readers that Moses had previously or already drawn near to God's location. There's a lot of coming and going here that we aren't specifically told about in the way that the material is written. So again, commentators have noted that we have to presume Moses had descended at some point prior to Exodus 24. So sometime between Exodus 20 and Exodus 24, Moses had come down and now he's summoned to go back up. A couple of other sort of cursory comments. Nadab and Abihu, these are two of Aaron's sons who were priests. They're the same two that are going to die later in Leviticus 10, 1 through 3 for offering, you know, quote unquote, strange fire. If you want to know my thoughts on that, go back to the Leviticus series and listen to the episode on Leviticus 10 for that. We have a reference to the 70 elders. Sarna notes that 70 elders are mentioned again only in Numbers 11, 16 and verses 24 through 25 and Ezekiel 8, 11. As in Exodus 1:5, he writes, the number 70 has symbolic force expressing totality or comprehensiveness. In other words, it represents the entire community of Israel, okay, the people just generally. Worship from afar. Again, you guys come up, okay? Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. Now, Sarna takes this as an idiom, and he's not the only scholar who does. And I thought this was interesting enough to point out, make it part of the episode. He writes this about worshiping from afar. Throughout the ancient Near East, full-length prostration of the body was a conventional gesture expressing unconditional submission and homage to a superior authority. Let me just stop there. So the vision that we often have in our heads about worshiping from afar is, well, probably nothing. We probably don't even think about it. But worship from afar, it's like, oh, what'd they do? Did they set up a little altar like at some distance from God and do stuff there? Or did they like have incense? Or like, well, what's going on with the worship? And what Sarna is going to point out here is that, no, the reference is that they're going to bow. They're going to prostrate themselves. They're going to worship at a distance. So he says, the present instruction is to be understood as part of the formal ceremonial attending the ratification of the covenant. So he thinks it's part of the overall ceremony. It was not simply an act of worshipful reverence. From afar, this phrase might be construed to mean that they had to keep their distance from the mountain summit. However, the figurative use of the idiom to prostrate oneself from afar is found in letters to royalty from Ugarit in both the native language and in Akkadian, suggesting a recognized diplomatic courtesy on the part of a vassal who makes repeated prostrations starting at a distance from the suzerain's presence. Jacob's performance in meeting Esau, as told in Genesis 33:3, illustrates this practice. Quote, he himself went on ahead and bowed low to the ground 7 times until he was near his brother. End of quote, and end of Sarna's quote. So, you know, it's easy to read that incidence with Jacob back in Genesis 33 and think that he got on his knees and he bowed 7 times. But what Sarna is suggesting, based upon the parallels here, found in the material from Ugarit, is that Jacob bowed once 7 times, like getting progressively closer to Esau. It starts, the worship starts from afar and then, you know, gradually moves toward the individual. And so Sarna, again, is just wondering, hey, you know, it seems like this could be what's in view here, that you all start from afar, you're prostrating yourselves, and then the area is sort of zoned off into these gradations of sacred space that some are allowed onto and others are not. It just presents a different picture than what we might have in our heads. Now, in verses 3 and 4, we read, Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words of the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. So Moses essentially tells everybody how God wants things to go, how he wants them to run. They agree. And Moses records what is to happen. Apparently, the point is that these stipulations and their actions were to become part of the description of the treaty with Yahweh. In other words, part of the ratification procedure, and Sarna had alluded to that earlier. Built an altar. Again, we just saw recently the rules for building altars before there was the brazen altar. Exodus 20, verse 24 said this, an altar of earth you shall make for me and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. So it's interesting, again, that Moses is, you know, he builds an altar at the foot of the mountain. Again, that signifies where the name is. Okay, let me read Exodus 20:24 again. The altars are supposed to be built out of earth. Okay, in every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. So it's kind of a roundabout way of affirming the name theology idea again. He builds an altar at the foot of the mountain. The mountain is where God is, and the mountain is also where the name is. The name is another way of referring to God. Okay, so it's just a, again, that content should be familiar to those of you who listen regularly to the podcast. And of course, if you've read Unseen Realm, name theology is something that should be in the forefront of your mind. The reference to the 12 pillars is kind of interesting. And I'm going to say something here, and I'm going to actually return to this item toward the end of the episode, because there's sort of an interesting possible curveball that deals with the 12 pillars idea. But for now, the text is very clear that these 12 pillars that are erected, probably 12 standing stones, you know, stones of some size that are erected in vertical formation. The 12 pillars here are, quote, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay, they are not according to the 12 signs of the zodiac. Okay, so for those of you who want to do internet theology or run into internet theology, that is not what the text says. We have here, very clearly, according to the 12 tribes of Israel, the pillars represent the people, the 12 tribes. And so that likely needs to frame how we view the later sprinkling of blood, quote, on the people in verse 8. Now, if you think about it, it's very easy to read this that the blood, you know, there's people are gathered around there at the foot of the mountain. I mean, there's a lot of people here. And Moses is holding a couple basins, you know, right, of blood. It's not like 1,000 gallons, okay, where, and they don't have a fire hose where they're going to like sprinkle all the blood. They don't have like a helicopter or, you know, crane or something where somehow that he's going to be able to throw the blood on every last Israelite that's gathered at the foot of the mountain. It's just absurd. So the assumption is typically he's out there flinging blood and it hits some people and most, but 99% of the congregation, they don't get wet. Okay. They don't get any blood on them. Well, what Sarna and others have suggested is that since these 12 standing stones, these 12 pillars represent the people very obviously because there's one for each tribe. They say maybe what actually happened was that the blood was sprinkled on the pillars. You'd get all of them that way. And then by extension, you know, emblematically, it would cover all of the people of Israel. They were all part of the covenant. They're all responsible. You can't, an Israelite couldn't say, well, I didn't get wet. You know, no blood got on me. So I'm not, you know, I'm not accountable to that. No, that isn't the point. It's easy to see, again, if it was sprinkled actually on the pillars, and that so the phrase on the people really means on the pillars, then everybody's included. So it's just kind of interesting. Sarna, just again to write or to note what he says here. He says, it is likely that the dashing of the blood, quote, on the people, described in verse 8, was effectuated by sprinkling it over the pillars. In Genesis 31, 45 through 54, an upright pillar, Hebrew it's Matzevah, served as a mute witness to a treaty between Jacob and Laban. A large stone was similarly used to commemorate the covenant between God and Israel made at Shechem. The note in Joshua 24:27 is instructive, Sarna writes, which says this. This is Sarna's translation. See, this very stone shall be a witness against us, for it heard all the words that the Lord spoke to us, unquote. Well, obviously stones don't have ears. And so this idea is that the stone represents the individuals that did hear everything. It's treated as though it were those persons. And so if that's the case, again, Sarna's point here is that the 12 pillars here, since it's very clear they do represent the 12 tribes of Israel, it's quite possible, and Sarna thinks this is much more plausible, and indeed this he thinks this is what happened, that the blood was actually sprinkled on the pillars, on the standing stones. So the 12 stones were therefore a memorial and a participant in the actual ceremony. Carpenter writes, these pillars served as a silent testimony to the covenant and commitment of each tribe to Yahweh and Yahweh's commitment to them, unquote. So again, that's kind of an interesting side note that I think is pretty coherent, again, given the circumstances and given the symbolic meaning of these upright, you know, standing stones elsewhere in the Old Testament and in the ancient Near Eastern thinking. So verse 5, you know, we have a reference to the sacrifices. He sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. So there's two types of offerings, burnt offerings, peace offerings. Sarna, again, has an interesting note here. He writes, the two types of sacrifice are the olah, that's Hebrew for burnt offering, and the shelamim, Hebrew for peace offerings. The latter term, often rendered as peace offerings, is more accurately an offering of well-being or a sacrifice of greeting. Again, you'd go back in the Leviticus series and you'd get some of that language there too. Sarna continues, the first, that is the burnt offering, the olah, was wholly consumed by fire upon the altar. The second, the peace offering, was shared, certain parts being burnt, and the rest consumed by the worshiper. The sacrifice of shelamim, peace offerings, was a kind of shared sacred meal. And that's going to become interesting in verse 11, which is part two of you know, our podcast episodes on Exodus 24, because they do have a meal. I mean, there is some kind of meal going on in the picture. Verses 6 through 8, what is done with the blood has drawn a lot of interest. Okay. So we've got here, Moses takes half of the blood, puts it in basins, half the blood he throws against the altar. So half of it's gone by the time you get to verse 7. Then he took the book of the covenant, he reads it in the hearing of the people. And then in verse 8, Moses took the blood and the rest of it and threw it on the people, or most likely on the standing stones that represented the people, and said, "Behold the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." So the fact that the blood is divided up into basins and two different things are done with it, again, has drawn, you know, some interest, actually a lot of scholarly debate on why this is so, because the ceremony is unusual. It's one of only three passages where blood is said to be applied to people in any sense, even if pillars are meant. And this division of the blood is also, you know, unusual. So I'm going to read a couple of opinions on this about what the meaning of the ceremony actually would have been, and the casting of the blood on, quote unquote, on the people and on the altar and all that sort of stuff. Why are they doing this? And what are the thoughts that people, that readers, ancient readers, and the writer and the witnesses would have been thinking when they see this done? Okay, so Sarna chimes in this way. He says, "The blood of the Olah, the burnt offering, and the Shelemim, peace offerings, was always collected and dashed against the sides of the altar," you know, in every other instance. "In the present ceremony, Moses performs this standard ritual with only half of the blood. He stored the other half in basins for later sprinkling on the people." Verse 8. "The two parts were for the two parties to the covenant, God and Israel, respectively. The significance of the sprinkling of the blood is never explained. However, the prevailing notion in Israel was that the blood, the vital bodily fluid, constituted the life force. As such, like life itself, it belonged to God alone. For that reason, its consumption by humans is strictly forbidden." Let me stop there again. We discussed this a lot in the series on Leviticus. So back to Sarna. "For that reason, its consumption by humans is strictly forbidden, and the blood of sacrifices is dashed on the altar. The use of blood in a covenant is found nowhere else in the Bible. The ordination of Aaron as high priest, as related in Leviticus 8, involved daubing the blood of the sacrificial lamb of ordination on parts of his body and on the altar. It is likely that in both these ceremonies, the covenant and then the ordination, the blood functions mysteriously to cement the bond between the involved parties. Though through God's sharing, as it were, of the vital fluid with Israel or with Aaron, the life of the recipient is thought to take on a new dimension and to be elevated to a higher level of intimate relationship with the deity." That's the end of the Sarna quote. Now, John Hilber, who was a speaker at our first Naked Bible Conference, and you've heard him also in podcast interviews at SBL, he has an article called "The Theology of Worship in Exodus 24. Let me share some of his thoughts about this. He writes, "Others see the significance of the tossing of blood on both the altar and the people as symbolizing the coming together of the two parties in covenant. Gordon Wenham advances this interpretation by noting a similarity between this rite and the ceremonies of priestly ordination, Leviticus 8, and of the cleansing of a healed person, Leviticus 14. In both Exodus 24 and the Levitical rituals, blood is applied to both the altar and to the worshiper, symbolizing renewed communion." Okay. Ronald Hendel, again, Hilber's just going through a bunch of different views here. Hendel adds that the splashing of blood serves a lasting communicative function. Blood remaining on the altar is a visible reminder of the performance of sacrifice and its corresponding blessing, which is the establishment of the covenant relationship. Another possibility is that since blood symbolizes life, spattered blood appropriately dramatizes the consequence of breaking covenant, that is, violent death. That's the end of the Hilber quote. So again, we may not be really thinking these thoughts, but when they throw the blood on the altar like this, nobody says, "Okay, we're done with that," or "time out," and they don't get their squeegee. They don't get, you know, their little spray bottle of whatever it is, disinfect it, go up there and clean the thing off. No, it's a sacred, sanctified item that is not to be touched in any other way other than the way it's supposed to be used, you know, if ever. So Hilber's thing is that, look, you know, in some cases, leaving the blood there might have, again, been emblematic. It might have taught people. And when are they going to see it? Well, they're going to see it when the elements are taken apart and packaged and then carried and reassembled and all that stuff. You could catch a glimpse, of maybe the blood on the altar or something like that. And you would be reminded that, hey, that blood's there because we, had this covenant ceremony, or because, we need to be purged so we can enter sacred space. Or again, in the covenant context, if the person who sees this is thinking of the covenant, it's like, well, if I violate the covenant, it's violent death, So, again, Hilbert's just running us through the possibilities here. Now, again, none of these have won the day. And in fact, a more recent article by Amy Peeler is kind of interesting. It's called Desiring God, the Blood of the Covenant in Exodus 24. And this is a BBR, Bulletin for Biblical Research article, written in 2013. And she goes through, again, the different views of this and doesn't really, again, like any of them. She tried, she wants to make her own contribution, which I think is noteworthy. So in this article, she goes through a list of interpretations as to the ritual's significance and therefore the blood's significance. All the options have some kind of problem. And so she theorizes that the answer may involve more than one option or, again, what she's going to propose. So to summarize her article, she lists the main options as roughly, again, this is just my summary, roughly as follows. There are those who say the ritual is a cultic event that seals the covenant between God and the congregation. That much at least is kind of obvious in light of verses 3 and 7. Okay, the question is whether is that all the ritual meant? So it means at least that much, because the text pretty much says that. But is that all it means? So there are those who say, well, it was probably also a sanctifying or purifying act. That is, the blood purged the people. The manipulation or the handling of the blood here bears some resemblance to Leviticus 8:9, which others have pointed out. The idea here in Exodus 24 would be that after the application of the blood, the people are purified, but the text never tells us from what or for what reason or, why. There's no tabernacle yet. So there's no, area of sacred space except for the mountain. And the people can't generally go to the mountain. God has already told them that. So what do they need to be purged from? I mean, that's a legit question that doesn't seem to get answered. So third category, and the Hilber quotation, alluded to this, that the blood signifies that the people's blood would so be shed if they were to break the covenant. All right. So they're placed under obligation of the covenant and will reap the consequences if they don't keep it. Now, Peeler's sort of pushback to that idea is that makes it feel like the ritual of Exodus 24 places a blood curse on the altar, and she doesn't like that. This just kind of gives her an icky feeling, okay? It just seems a little bit wrong-headed to her. It also has the problem that when the covenant does get violated shortly thereafter with the golden calf incident, not everybody dies. I mean, some suffer a plague but don't die. Others die. So it seems like if this is what the ritual is about, hey, if you break the covenant, you're going to die. Well, not everybody who broke the covenant shortly thereafter died. So there's a disconnect there. And again, that's a legitimate observation. Now, what Peeler wants to contribute, I'm going to quote from her directly in this case. She writes on page 200 of her article. She says, three times in Exodus, after meeting with God on the mountain, Exodus 19:3, 20:21, 34:2, Moses passes on the words of the Lord to the people. Exodus 19:7, 24:3, 34:32, as the specifications of the covenant. Again, Exodus 19:24 and 34 have all that in there. So you get these three instances. The differences between the ceremonies themselves, now look at what they involve. They meet with God, Moses passes on the words of the Lord to the people, and then you get the specifics of the covenant. So she says the differences between those three ceremonies themselves and also their effects show the blood ceremony alters the people's proximity to God. It alters their fear of God and, again, is a motivation for their obedience. Now, in sum, she writes, the people initially out of fear obey so that God's presence remains distant. This is in the earlier episodes, okay? Not Exodus 24, but the instances she cites that happened earlier. So initially, the people obey out of fear so that God's presence is distant and mediated to them by Moses. Then the Israelites have no fear when some of the people experience God's glory as close and unmediated, and the rest, desiring this, unfortunately act in disobedience to achieve it. Finally, the people overcome their fear with stirred hearts, and with stirred hearts obey to bring about the close but appropriately mediated divine presence in their midst. So she's saying, look, in the one instance, they want to stay away from God. And they specifically ask Moses, this is back in Exodus 20, hey, you do that God thing, you know, we don't want to be anywhere near that because we're going to die. And then later in 34, after the people have seen some of the stuff going on the mountain, they want some of that. And so that's when you get the golden calf problem. And in between those two episodes, keep God away, hey, let's build ourselves, you know, an idol, and let's worship the Lord right here. In between that, you get Exodus 24. And so what Peeler is arguing, she says, what can account for these shifts? Keep God away, let's do that ourselves, and then now Exodus 24 somewhere in the middle. What can account for the shifts? Well, the difference between the three is the blood ceremony. She says, the blood ceremony is a striking event that grabs the attention of readers for its profusion and singularity, and it accounts for the reactions of the people in each event. Now, I think, this is me breaking, I think her best point is something she says a little bit later. It doesn't rule out a covenant ratification meaning at all, because again, that's obvious, but it actually goes nicely with it. She writes this, the accompanying peace offering involved the congregation more directly in the sacrificial worship. Once the animal was killed, the blood applied to the altar, and the fat burned in offering to God, the people were allowed to eat the meat of the sacrifice. The primary motivation of this offering was to rejoice. It signified the well-being that existed between God and his people. Not that they communed together, no meat was offered to God in Exodus 24, but that all the people rejoiced and celebrated before the Lord. Even here, the blood rite is clearly the quintessential element in the well-being offering. It prepares for and makes possible the subsequent celebration in God's presence. In sum, in the sacrificial system, blood atoned both the place of offering and the people so that gifts could be safely given to God and so that celebration could take place with him. By mentioning these specific offerings in Exodus 24, the reader expects similar results. So, let me summarize that. Taking what Peeler says and just some of these other observations, the best guess as to the meaning of the blood scattering on the people, or the 12 pillars, whatever the case may be, is that A, it sealed the covenant. Again, that's the obvious part. And B, it prepared people for God's presence. It was part of, if you want to put it a little bit crudely, it was kind of like table setting. Okay, it's part of setting up the circumstances where they're going to have a meal, you know, with the Lord. Now, the people on the mountain, I mean, they in verses 9 through 11, which we'll do in part 2, it says they saw the God of Israel. They had a meal and they saw the God of Israel. They ate and drank and they saw God. Well, the peace offerings for the rest of the populace on the ground kind of accomplishes the same thing, because the peace offerings were supposed to be, part of it was supposed to be eaten by the participant as kind of a communal meal, right? This is what she's trying to argue. Now, that makes good sense, again, in the context of the people as a whole being a kingdom of priests, because the priests get blood applied to them, remember, back in Leviticus. And the people do here, either by proxy of the 12 pillars or something directly. They're a, you know, kingdom of priests, so that it's not surprising there'd be similarities between what happens to the priests when they're ordained and this scene. You also have this fellowship meal going on. Again, the ceremony accomplishes all these goals prior to the establishment of the priesthood later, you know, Aaron's line, which is going to come later in the book of Exodus. Or the creation of sacred space in the tabernacle. That's also going to come later in the book of Exodus. So she says this is what's kind of going on here. It has a dual purpose, or maybe even three purposes. And she kind of, you know, wants to get away from, oh, it was designed to scare people or freak them out when they saw the blood. Oh, if we violate the covenant, that's what's going to happen to us. You know, it's not necessarily purging for sacred space. It's highlighting who they are, a kingdom of priests. We draw near to God. We celebrate a meal with him, just that sort of thing. So I think what she says makes good sense there. I have one more rabbit trail in the episode for today. And we're going to come back to the 12 pillars here. So we've been through the covenant ceremony. Again, the big issue that people really want to talk about is, why is it the way it is? Because it's so different. And we just covered that. So I want to go on one little rabbit trail here. about the 12 pillars. Now, this is something that would not immediately occur to, you know, not only the casual reader, but a serious Bible student. Although I guess there's a chance it might, if you were kind of reading the New Testament in tandem with Exodus and you hit the right spots at the same time, it might. So the 12 pillars language, again, was emblematic of Israel, the people of God. I want to read Galatians 2:9 here. This is Paul writing, and he says, "When James and Cephas, Peter, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given to me, they gave the right hand of fellowship to Barnabas and me, that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised." Now, this is really odd, this reference to Peter, you know, and James and John as pillars. There's a really interesting article. It's pretty technical, but he's got some interesting stuff. Roger Ouse, A-U-S, and I have referenced his name before on the podcast. Ouse is an out-of-the-box thinker. I really like what he writes. So when I saw this article, Three Pillars and Three Patriarchs, a Proposal, it's in some German journal, I thought, okay, you know, Ouse always has something interesting to say, and I was not disappointed. Again, so I'm going to read you a few excerpts from this article just to see what he's kind of angling for. Like, what relationship does the language of Galatians 2, Peter, James, and John, the three pillars, what might it have to back here in Exodus 24, the 12 pillars? Okay. So he opens his article this way. I'm just going to give you some scattershot here from Ouse. "In his letter to the churches of Galatia, Paul provides us with some invaluable firsthand information concerning the early situation of the Jerusalem church, about which we unfortunately know precious little from other sources. Among other things, the apostle to the Gentiles relates in Galatians 2:9 that at a meeting in Jerusalem, James, Cephas, and John, quote, reputed to be pillars," and then he quotes the Greek text, "gave him and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship. The latter two were to go to the Gentiles. The pillars, on the other hand, were to missionize among the circumcised." The commentators speak only in general terms of this non-Pauline phrase. Again, he calls it non-Pauline because he's going to tie it in with some early Second Temple rabbinic, you know, literature, you know, use of that term. So it's not unique. Paul didn't invent it. Okay. "The commentators speak only in general terms of this non-Pauline phrase, reputed to be pillars, nor are the two special studies of this expression entirely satisfying," and then he cites them, basically saying, "I don't think they get it. Rabbinic and intertestamental sources concerning the pillars of Israel, however, offer new insights into the self-understanding of the early Jerusalem church, including how it conceived its three leaders, James, Peter, and John. They also provide us with a better understanding of Paul's relationship to the Jerusalem church as expressed, again, in his book, Galatians." Now, that just, you know, sort of sets the issue up. And Ouse begins talking about the fact in the New Testament, the apostles obviously are connected with the new covenant community because there's a new covenant and with a new Jerusalem. And he talks a little bit about how the church is conceived of as a new Israel and a new Jerusalem in different books of the New Testament. So this whole thing about new Jerusalem is, if you think forward to the book of Revelation, this is the way the New Jerusalem gets talked about. The apostles are mentioned, you know, the 12 tribes are mentioned. They're sort of part of the building, you know, people being part of the building. It's this metaphorical language. And so he says in both of the latter, these references to the New Jerusalem, the motif of pillars plays an important role. Okay, at the outset of his public ministry, Jesus chooses 12 disciples, a reconstituting of the 12 tribes of Israel. And at the Last Supper, he inaugurated a new covenant with the 12, indicating a new Israel. In the covenant ratification ceremony of Exodus 24, Moses at the foot of Mount Sinai erected 12 pillars, according to the 12 tribes. He then threw the blood of the covenant upon the people of Israel. Since in rabbinic sources the Messiah is often viewed as the final redeemer, the first being Moses, the connection between Moses' 12 pillars and the blood of the covenant and Jesus the Messiah and the 12 disciples and the blood of the new covenant is striking. Okay, and he goes on, he talks about Revelation 21:12, the gates of the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down from heaven in the eschatological age. On those gates, the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel are inscribed. Revelation 5:14 states the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb are on the 12 foundations of the wall. Here the 12 disciples of Jesus support the new Israel, the Christian church. They function as its foundation, a term parallel to and at times interchangeable with pillars. And he again cites, you know, some passages for that and also some rabbinic stuff. So you can see kind of he's, you know, what he's already angling for. He's building a case, you know, of these connections. And I want to make one, just two more things here. I mean, you can kind of see that there's a connection here between the 12 and the pillars, the new Israel, the old Israel, all that sort of stuff. So he writes a little bit later, I would suggest that the number the three, we're talking about why are there three pillars instead of 12? Okay, why does Paul single out Peter, James, and John? He says, I would suggest the number three in Galatians 2:9 is due to a deliberate selection by the Aramaic-speaking Jerusalem church of three disciples or apostles as community leaders on the basis of the model of the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Because those three, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were thought of in rabbinic sources as the three pillars of Israel, indeed of the entire world, to the rabbis. While the three fathers or patriarchs can also be called or described as fathers of the world, the princes of the world, the sureties or guarantees of Israel, God's servants, God's companions, God's holy ones, God's heavenly chariot. I mean, look at these terms in rabbinic literature. The three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and together they collectively symbolize Israel as an entity. Okay? And it's only with the last one that you get the 12 tribes. Okay? But before that, they were the entity. They were Israel. Okay? So they get referred to in rabbinic materialists, fathers of the world, princes of the world, guarantees of Israel, God's servants, God's companions, God's holy ones, God's heavenly chariot. In addition to those, okay, they get called pillars. Okay. And so, you know, Aust draws attention to this and he's thinking, well, if there's this analogy between the three patriarchs, you know, he's proposing this, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Peter, James, and John. Well, of course, you might refer to them as three pillars. Again, that's the gist of what Aust is suggesting here. Again, he's an out-of-the-box kind of thinker, and he's trying to come to grips with why we get this pillar language and also why we have three singled out. So just to wrap this up here, he says here, the latter saying aids in understanding why James, Peter, and John were thought of as pillars by the earliest Jerusalem congregation, which was Jewish. Okay. As God once established the world, the covenant community Israel, on the basis of the three patriarchs, so in the Messianic period inaugurated by the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, God was thought of by Jewish Christians as having established the world anew, the new covenant community, the Israel of God, to employ Paul's phrase from Galatians 6:16, the Israel of God. God was reestablishing it on the basis of three new pillars, Peter, James, and John, again, hearkening back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by virtue of the language of pillars. So I just thought that was really kind of interesting. I wanted to throw that into the episode because we hit, you know, that language here in the passage where it very evidently refers to the tribes. That's what we have now. We don't have the patriarchs anymore. When we get the pillar language in Exodus 24, we have the 12 tribes. But just as the 12 tribes represent Israel, the collected people of God, when you get to Jacob's time and afterward, before Jacob's time, it was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So if Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would have been standing at the mountain, again, the reasoning would be, well, there would have been three pillars erected, not 12. Again, to symbolize the covenant ratification. You know, which of course, you know, basically he's saying, as in the Gospels, you get this 12 imagery that connects the church with Israel. Here in Galatians 2:9, you get the three pillar imagery that connects the church back to Israel. So I think that's some really good fodder for thought there. It seems to make sense. You get intertestamental context for it. You get some rabbinic context for it. It seems to make good sense of the language in Galatians 2:9. So there you go. But next time on the podcast, we will talk about the rest of the chapter, and most specifically verses 9 through 11. That's kind of the guts there. But we'll traverse into some of the other material as well, just a little bit. But next time, part 2, we'll hit Exodus 24, the rest of the chapter, again, mostly 9 through 11.
Sounds good, Mike. We'll be looking forward to that. And I just want to remind people, if you weren't able to catch our conference live, you can still watch it till January 12th, the end of the day. Go to nakedbibleconference.com, click the live stream, and you'll be able to watch the replay with that, Mike. And with that, I'll get everybody out. And we look forward to part two next week. All right, we appreciate it. And I want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.